The Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines has been through many changes since its founding as the Great Ape Trust. Now, the initiative is ready to open a new chapter. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative is home to a unique family of bonobos, including world-famous Kanzi, who can communicate with humans through the use of lexigrams and clearly understands spoken language. Now, ACCI has plans to increase the number of bonobos in Des Moines and the world by getting involved in breeding this endangered species. This hour, the future of ACCI and breeding endangered species in captivity. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines is home to a unique family of bonobos, including world-famous Kanzi, who can communicate with humans through the use of lexigrams and clearly understands some spoken language. Kanzi is 37 years old, and he's been part of a language acquisition and cognition research project for almost his entire life. He and the other bonobos came to Iowa in 2004, when what was then called the Great Ape Trust was founded under the leadership of psychologist and primatologist Sue Savage Rumbaugh. Many changes have taken place over the years, and the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative is now led by Jared Tagliatella. He is the director of research at ACCI and an associate professor at Kennesaw State University in Georgia. We last visited the ACCI just over a year ago, and Jared took us up on the roof so we could see the bonobos enjoying a beautiful spring day outdoors.
There were two nests, you can see. That's one on the ground over there, which is not very typical, but Inyota was sleeping in that earlier.
So wait, when you say nest on the ground, that looks like a bag. Is
no, it's a bunch of blankets, actually.
Okay.
So in the wild, bonobos make a new nest every night to sleep in, and they'll use what's available to them, branches and leaves, and they usually make them pretty high up in the trees. Our guys like to sleep high up, too, in their indoor enclosures, but we provide them with, most of the time, blankets, and they'll weave them together into these pretty elaborate and what looked to be, although I've never tried one, comfy nests. You can see evidence of one as well. This is sort of the day nests, the one they make during the day for little napping periods, are usually not as involved as the night ones. But I think Tico has left his remnants on that tall tower there in that yard. And then there's another one way out there on the ground. So I think that the bonobos were enjoying watching some of the waterfowl that are around the property.
Nice. Just a little sound from our last visit to the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative. Today, we're going to talk about what's going on at ACCI and look to the future. With me on the line is Jared Tagliatella. Hi, Jared.
Hey, how are you?
Good. It's nice to talk to you again.
Yes, nice to talk to you.
Now, last time we visited up on that rooftop in Des Moines and we were watching the bonobos, we were talking about the future of the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative. And your plans for the future have changed pretty dramatically since that last conversation. At that point, you were talking about trying to move the research project back to Georgia, which is where it was originally founded. What are your plans for the future right now?
Yeah, I mean, I should probably start by saying that, I mean, I think at some point, you know, that's not necessarily completely off the table about maybe moving the organization or even part of the organization. But really, when we started to think about strategically how we would go about kind of making that change, we started to run into a number of hurdles. You know, and I think that probably given the age of the organization, we've really only been around as the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative, you know, we started in late 2013. So we're still pretty young. And we kind of strategically decided that it was really in the organization's best interest, but most importantly in the bonobos' best interest, to grow and kind of where we were, with the idea that one day we might move all or part of the organization to another facility, But for now, really, we really kind of wanted to continue what we had started in Des Moines and keep the organization sort of with the same mission we've had, but just make perhaps grow our resources. And typically, and really what we decided was, let's just try to keep doing what we were doing before we made any drastic changes.
Well, and the ACCI is home to a family of five bonobos, and those bonobos are related to each other, right?
Yes, that's correct. So all of them, they've all lived together for quite a long time, but all of the individuals, with the exception of actually Kanzi, are kin to one another. So in terms of, getting new bonobos, or in terms of growing our colony, we're going to need to look elsewhere.
Well, and let's talk about what you're doing at the ACCI right now. Just a little bit of a review of the research that you're doing at the moment. When we visited last time, you had made a lot of changes at the facility to make it a much more engaging, healthy environment for the bonobos. But you are continuing and really restarting, getting a lot of research back on track with these unique bonobos who have this background of language acquisition, of understanding lexigrams. What are you focusing your research on right now?
Yeah, so we've kind of continued to develop those programs. I guess it's been about a year, maybe even a little over a year since you guys were out there. And what we've continued with the same types of research, so cognitive, behavioral research, a lot of it focused on communication and language. Some of the really kind of exciting things that we've been able to do over the course of, developments over the past year is that we've been able to start actually assessing our youngest bonobo, Tico. We've started to look at his human language comprehension, as well as his use of lexigrams in a sort of controlled experimental setting. I think we've talked about this before, but for people that don't know, Kanzi sort of is world famous as a bonobo because, at least in part, of his comprehension of human spoken English. And that's been experimentally assessed back in 1993. He was compared to a 2.5-year-old child at the time and did really favorably on novel sentences. That'd be things he would have never heard before. And he apparently learned the ability to understand spoken English observationally, so very similar to the way human children learn spoken English or learn spoken language. And so we know that Tico, we don't have a lot of information on Tico's early rearing before ACCI came about, but we know the type of environment he's in now, where people are using spoken English around him and when he's interacting, as we do with all the other bonobos. And so we've been able to train him on a computer task that lets us kind of assess how much English he actually understands.
Well, and last time we visited, we recorded a little bit of Nicole Scott, who research coordinator and facility manager for ACCI, working with Anyota and Tico in your cognitive testing booth. And let's listen to a little bit about what she was doing.
So great. This is where we do most of our cognitive testing with the apes. So most of the cognitive testing is on computer. So we have a touchscreen computer. This is a 24-inch. And so what Tico is doing right now is called match to sample. So he sees a sample. So in that one, it was an ear. It disappears, and then you have two choices that pop up. So he sees the same picture of an ear he just saw, and then he also saw a picture of, I believe it was pineapple. So in order to get it right, he has to touch the picture of the ear again. So this is a common process that we use for lots of different research projects. One that Kanzi is doing right now is an ape identification study, where he'll see a picture of an ape he knew from his past. So Matata, his adoptive mother, or Piske was a male that used to be a part of this group. Both have since passed away. And so we're seeing if he remembers them, if he can match their picture, if he recognizes them. So it's a way to look at if they have memories of the past.
And Tico, when he makes a match, he gets a frozen grape every time he makes a match?
Every time he gets a match, yes. Kanzi is the only one who doesn't necessarily get rewarded with every correct answer because he's so good and he can do so many trials. He would fill up on grapes for the day if we let him.
And Tico keeps looking over here. Why do you think he's doing that? I mean, he's not necessarily paying all of his attention to the screen.
Yes, but he's still getting them correct. Yeah. So he has really good memory. A lot of it is there seems to be some intrinsic motivation where they like to please people. So he gets as much motivation for doing the work for getting frozen grapes as he does for making us happy by participating in the task and having an audience to show off for.
They like to stare into your eyes, too. Yeah. It's like they get a benefit from that connection. I think as much as we do. At least as much as we do. Yeah.
That's a little bit of sound from our last visit to the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines. And that was Nicole Scott working with Nyota and Tico in their cognitive testing booth. And Jared, recently I was watching Nova Wonders. You were featured in part of a segment on PBS stations around the country. And something you said really struck me. You said that Kanzi and the other bonobos in this research project are probably the last of their kind because research has changed so much and our interest in research has changed so much. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so we were talking about sort of Kanzi's linguistic upbringing. So Kanzi was raised in an environment in which he was interacting directly with humans. And I think the basic question, although I think it changed over the course of the project with Kanzi, even in the early days, was to look at how much human language a bonobo could acquire, could understand, and then also could use themselves again through these colorful symbols we call lexigrams. And I think we learned quite a lot about that. We learned that, like I said, Kanzi came to understand a sophisticated level of spoken language, and we're actually still assessing that now. But what the focus has kind of shifted, because really that work with Kanzi brings up a really, really interesting question, and that is, through our understanding now of how much human language Kanzi was able to acquire, the question really is, did that fundamentally somehow change Kanzi, or is it that we were just tapping into a communication system that already exists in bonobos? And that's really kind of where the research has shifted from. It shifted away from this idea of seeing if they can acquire our language and more looking at decoding what it is that they're doing with one another. And so we're really excited about the prospect of that. And part of that piece of the puzzle includes, increasing our colony size so we can look at the richness of communication among bonobos.
So it sounds like you're saying there's a shift from a more human-centric idea of studying animal behavior to a more animal-centric behavior idea.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to characterize it. I mean, I think you can think about it as Kanzi acquired our language, and what we are trying to do now is, given what we've learned about how he did that and the extent to which he did that, it sort of gives us a bit of a window into their, not only their communicative world, but their social world and their cognitive world. And now we kind of have a way to look at more closely, or at least have some clues at what we should be looking at to determine, the sophistication of their communication system.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Jared Tagliatella. He is the director of research at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines, also an associate professor at Kennesaw State University in Georgia. We're talking about the future of the ACCI and also the future of bonobos as a species. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines. It's home to a unique family of bonobos, including world-famous Kanzi, who can communicate with humans through the use of lexigrams. He also clearly understands quite a bit of spoken language. Kanzi is 37 years old. He's been involved in this kind of research, language acquisition, cognition research, almost his entire life, and the other bonobos at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative have been involved in this kind of research as well. Now, the research is continuing, and also the ACCI is planning changes for the future. With me right now is Jared Tagliatella. He is the director of research at ACCI. He's also an associate professor at Kennesaw State University in Georgia. And Jared, just before the break, we were talking about how really the focus of research in animal cognition is changing really worldwide among researchers, whereas when Kanzi was young and this kind of research was developed, the idea was to see if a bonobo, a great ape, could acquire our language. And I think a lot of us remember a lot of the language acquisition programs like Coco the gorilla and sign language. And there was the Washoe Project with chimpanzees and sign language. And the focus now is more on understanding how these animals might communicate with each other and learning about how they might think from watching their behavior. Do you feel like Kanzi and Tico and Inyota and the other bonobos at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative, with their unique background, do you feel like they can help us make a leap to increasing our understanding of sort of those natural communications?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's really, really the strength that in terms of research that we have at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative. Like I said, a lot of what we've learned about Kanzi's understanding of human language has kind of shed a lot of insight onto what possibly is going on with bonobos using their sort of quote-unquote natural communicative signals. And I think it's important to note, you know, when we're interacting with Kanzi, especially in sort of relaxed settings where we're not collecting data from him and we're just doing the daily things that go on during the day, Kanzi understands spoken English. He uses lexigram symbols. We use lexigram symbols with him, but he also uses all of the other communication, sort of communicative signals that another bonobo anywhere would use. So there's facial expressions, there's his own vocalizations, there's gestures and body postures. So he's using this, and we kind of think of his ability to comprehend spoken English and use lexigrams as just sort of another, for lack of a better way of saying it, another tool in his toolkit. And so when we as humans are faced with a problem or something that we need to communicate to someone else, right, we use different modalities. Right now I'm speaking to you over the phone. If we were together in a crowded space that was very noisy, we might rely more on visual communication. And I think it's important to remember that we have good evidence now that says that bonobos and chimpanzees and other great apes are using these communicative signals to do things with their social partners. And that's kind of really where the focus has shifted. And I think given that our guys do have this unique linguistic upbringing, it kind of gives us a really unique way of looking at that and gaining some insight that you can get elsewhere.
I want to play another clip from our last visit to the ACCI that really exemplifies what you were just talking about. This next clip is from the greenhouse area of the facility. There are these old fire hoses that are strung up to give the apes a place to climb and to swing. And Jared and I were on one side of the glass. Kanzi was on the other side of the glass, and he was communicating with Jared and interacting with Jared through the window. And then Jared went back to the other side at Kanzi's request. Here, let's play a little bit of that audio.
Oh, and we're probably going to come up into the glass and
woo!
Boom.
Hi, Kanzi.
Hi.
Be nice. He wants me to go back there. You want me to chase you with the hose? He said chase using the symbol on the keyboard. But given all the water that's in there, I'm thinking that's what he's asking. Yeah. He's saying chase. So that gesture too, that clapping your hands together and then pointing at me is sort of his way of saying chase. So we could check it out. I could go back there real quick. And
yeah,
if you guys want to see it, you can
we'll watch you chase.
Yeah, we'll see. I could be wrong, so.
But I think if Kanzi says yes, you should do it.
So Jared turned the hose on and Kanzi in particular was very excited. He's right now rolling around on the floor, getting sprayed with the hose. He's got his mouth open. He also seems to be very aware of the fact that he's being watched because he will look over at us and sometimes come over and pound on the window. Right now he's bending over, looking backward between his legs.
That's a happy bonobo face right there. The little relaxed, Joe, we call that the play face. So. And now you're covered in water. Oof.
All right, just a little bit of sound from a play session of Jared and Kanzi interacting, clearly communicating and playing. In thinking about bringing more bonobos into this environment and starting to breed bonobos, first of all, tell me a little bit about the species and why bonobos are endangered, why breeding bonobos in captivity might be a good idea.
Sure. Well, the first thing is that bonobos are the same genus as chimpanzees, so they're closely related to chimpanzees, but they're only found in one small part of what's now Democratic Republic of Congo. And has made their conservation status a bit tricky there, given the sort of political environment and the remoteness in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We're not exactly sure how many in the wild. We are definitely sure that they are endangered, maybe even critically so. And the interesting thing about bonobos is that bonobos are, at least by all sort of accounts using modern evidence, is that they are believed to be sort of the most closely related great ape species to humans. And that relationship makes them really interesting for both studying our own origins, but also for looking at, you know, ways to possibly conserve them in the wild and their environment and their habitat.
So what would you need to do? What do you need to do to be able to bring more bonobos into this environment?
Right. So given that the bonobos are endangered, there's a regulatory group called the Species Survival Plan. And all animals in captivity that are endangered in the wild have what's called a Species Survival Plan. And this is, you know, a group of individuals that look very closely at the status of the captive population. They obviously consider the status of the animals in their natural habitats and are interested in making sure that the captive population is sustainable. And obviously, this is going to involve a lot of looking at sort of genetic differences between animals and relatedness between individuals and trying to devise a strategy for making sure that the captive population is as genetically viable. When it comes to bonobos, there aren't very many bonobos in captivity in North America. There's about 80 or so. And as we said, five of them are at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines. And so that makes, obviously, bonobos very, very unique. There are about seven facilities. Now, the seven facilities that, besides the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative, that house bonobos in the United States are all zoos. So we are, in fact, the only research facility in North America and one of only two in the world that actually house and study bonobos. So that, of course, is just unique in its own right. Because all the other groups are zoos and because bonobo breeding in captivity is regulated by the Bonobo Species Survival Plan, all of the zoos that have bonobos in the United States are accredited by an organization known as the Association for Zoos and Aquariums, or AZA for short. And AZA has very rigorous standards when it comes to, obviously, as you can imagine, keeping and in many cases for zoos, at least exhibiting animals. And so in order to participate with the Bonobo Species Survival Plan, we need to be certified by the AZA. And so this is a very rigorous process. It's undergoing now, so it's certainly not something that we've already passed, but we are very much in favor of doing this. I'm a scientist. I was trained as a scientist by co-director Bill Hopkins at Georgia State University as a scientist. So the thought of having oversight and transparency is exactly what we are interested in. So we're inspected by the USDA. We have a USDA exhibitor and research license. So we're looking at this sort of Association of Zoos and Aquariums certification as just another way of kind of making sure that we're doing everything right and making sure we're doing the best possible things we can for the animals that are in our care.
If you seek AZA and you are seeking AZA accreditation, does that change how you can and maybe even need to interact with the public?
No, actually, so technically speaking, and I don't want to bore anyone of the listeners here with the details, but technically speaking, we would be certified and not accredited. Zoos that exhibit animals are going to be accredited by the AZA. We would just be certified as what's called a related facility. So in terms of what we're doing research-wise, all of it is going to be basically the same. We just have some, you know, they have standards and benchmarks. And, of course, we want to make sure that we're conforming to or in line with those standards and benchmarks.
All right. And this would also give you the opportunity to bring other bonobos that are not genetically related to the bonobos in your care into the facility. That's the idea, right?
Yeah, that is totally the idea. And really, the reason for that is, you know, I should mention, by the way, that bonobos, as I said, there's about 80 of them. And all of the other facilities that that house and care for bonobos in the United States are basically at or even exceeding their capacity. So one of the things is we're a scientific organization, but we always say our mission is science, conservation, civic engagement. So we're dedicated to preserving all great apes worldwide, but particularly bonobos. We're dedicated to educating the public about these animals. We also are very interested in getting school children excited about not only about bonobos and conservation, but about doing science. And so getting certified by the AZA, which is again what we're seeking to do, and actually ultimately breeding our bonobos, we feel like we're positively contributing to all those aspects of our mission, because we're positively contributing to the conservation of the species in terms of the captive population, and it'll allow us to both fulfill our scientific and our education missions better.
Now, bonobos are something that if people have ever learned about this species, one of the things that makes them unusual among species, not unique because they share this with human beings at least, is that they are a very sexual species. They seem to engage in sex for the pleasure as opposed to just for procreation. I mean, that's a part of procreation, at least, is a part of the bonobo experience that the bonobos under your care have not really had an opportunity to engage in. So does that change what you'll be able to observe about their communication and their social structure to introduce that possibility into the lives of these captive apes?
Yeah, absolutely. So there is some sort of what we call sociosexual behavior that occurs with bonobos, and that is something that seems to happen or seems to be used in groups of bonobos to kind of ease tension and as an affiliative behavior among group members. Certainly bringing additional individuals in is going to allow our apes to have more enriched social lives. Certainly through breeding, the introduction of then infants into the group is going to make that social group more dynamic. Anyone who's ever been around a small child knows that the introduction of a toddler certainly changes.
Things get more exciting.
Yes, it does make it more exciting. And so we're looking forward to that. The other thing is that one thing about bonobos is that in addition to their sexual behavior is that they also are tend to be matriarchal. So females play a very predominant role. And at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative, we only have one female. And so we really think that in terms of both for the welfare of our apes, making their lives better, which is what we're constantly seeking to do, as well as the breeding potential, as well as the scientific value, the research value, that this is, you know, bringing in additional animals and having this breeding take place is really just a win-win all around.
Now, the breeding has been something that has had to be controlled at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative because these apes are so closely related. Are all of the bonobos at the ACCI, are they able to breed?
So ultimately that'll be a decision that's made by the Bonobo Species Survival Plan. So there'll be recommendations for breeding. Kanzi, sort of the most famous Kanzi, was actually vasectomized quite some time ago. And we haven't done any exams recently in terms of testing whether he has whether he would be able to breed. The previous ones that have been done have shown that he probably wouldn't as a result of that vasectomy. I know it sounds strange, but sometimes it has been known to occur that the vasectomies in great apes in particular have spontaneously reversed themselves. But with Kanzi, we don't think that's the case. All of the others, however, would likely, and again, I would have to, this would not be, this would be a recommendation from the Species Survival Plan, but all the others would likely be recommended for breeding.
What is your timeline for this?
Right. So, again, this is all very much we have submitted our application. That application is pending review. As I said, it's a very rigorous process, and it's a rigorous process that me and my co-directors and the whole staff actually really welcome, because we like the idea of showing, you know, the world, really, that we are a transparent organization, that we want to be doing the best we can for the apes in our care. I think best case scenario, a timeline might be as soon as sometime in late 2019 for us to potentially bring other bonobos to our facility.
And where would they come from? Do you already have an idea?
I really don't. Again, that would probably be under the recommendation. I mean, I know the large colonies of bonobos currently in the United States are going to be at the Milwaukee County Zoo, as well as the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium. So those obviously would be places just because they have a lot of bonobos there. You know, and I also should note that it's possible, and again, we have space for more bonobos. All of the other facilities seem to be at, or I should say, nearing at or over capacity. So in all likelihood, I think a recommendation would be to provide additional bonobos. There's also the possibility we might swap bonobos with other facilities.
Interesting. Well, we are going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. I'm talking with Jared Tagliatella. He is the director of research at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative, which is home to a unique family of bonobos, including world-famous Kanzi. We're talking about the future of the ACCI and the idea that the ACCI, if all things go smoothly, may be the home to a breeding program for bonobos in the not-too-distant future. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. We're also going to broaden the conversation to talk about breeding endangered species in captivity and the role that zoos play in this kind of conservation work. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we've been talking about research going on at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines, and also plans for the future to possibly breed bonobos, this endangered species, at that facility. With me is Jared Tagliatella. He is the director of research at ACCI and an associate professor at Kennesaw State University in Georgia. And we want to broaden the conversation a little bit, because zoos have changed a lot over the years and are now all over the world very involved in conservation of species in and even out of captivity. So to talk about the role of zoos in conservation of endangered species, we've invited Mark Vukovic here, president and CEO of Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And Val Hadakid, zookeeper at Blank Park Zoo, is also here. Hello, Val.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here. And Mark, I'll start with you to kind of give us a little bit of an overview. I know that this is something that you've been involved with in Blank Park Zoo. But at the zoo, what do you see as your mission with regard to breeding endangered species and trying to preserve species?
Well, it's really a twofold mission. The first part of our mission is, and this has been going on since the late 70s, is to maintain a self-sustaining zoo population without taking any animals from the wild. There's not been any animals removed from the wild into the American zoos except for very rare occasions. Like 2 years ago, Botswana was going to kill 18 elephants, and they put them in a paddock, and United Nations got involved. And in the end, six animals came to Denver, to Dallas, and to Wichita. But other than that real exception, most all animals in zoos you see in North America today have been bred in another zoo or that zoo. And so to do that, you really have to be careful when you have a captive breeding program that it maybe only has 200 animals in it. And that genetic diversity requires an extreme amount of record keeping and also requires an extreme amount of cooperation, where our baby rhino is now 15 months old. And when it gets to be 24 or 5 months, the Zoo Association, through the SSP program that was previously talked about, will decide where it goes and where a young male will come from. And all those decisions are made to preserve the genetic diversity of the species.
Right, because Blank Park Zoo, for those who don't know, is home to an eastern black rhino who was born at the zoo, and this is part of a conservation project.
Right, and what makes it even more important, as you know, as we continue to kill species of animals in the wild, you know, the National World Wildlife Federation thinks half the species in the world that were alive in 1900 are now gone, and you have animals in the wild where the populations are so fragmented. The eastern black rhino in Africa has 800 species in the wild. The real problem with that, though, is there's 30 over here and then 30 in another country 400 miles away, and there's not corridors for those animals to mix their genetic traits back and forth. So what happens in the wild is what you would think would happen in zoos is there's inbreeding. An example would be South African lions. The average weight has dropped to under 300 pounds along the northern part of South Africa because they have a fence separating them from Namibia and Angola because of civil wars, et cetera. North of that border where the animals run free, the average male lion's 400 pounds. So one thing zoos need to be doing is preserving that genetic diversity so as animals become more endangered and extinct in the wild, there's still a population that's viable at some time in the future may be able to be reintroduced.
Well, and actually, Jared, can you give us a little bit of an update on bonobos in the wild? As you mentioned, that they only seem to live in one really small area that is now in the Democratic Republic of Congo. But we don't even really know how many bonobos are in the wild, do we?
No, we don't. I mean, I've heard estimates that have, you know, varied drastically from somewhere, you know, as low as perhaps, you know, in the thousands, maybe 10,000, people going quite a little bit higher than that, maybe even approaching 100,000. So we really don't know. Certainly, I'd like to echo, you know, what Mark was saying with regards to the fact that fragmentation is certainly a major obstacle there with the animal. If these are isolated populations that no longer can interbreed, you lose the exchange of genetic material, and that becomes potentially very detrimental to the species.
Well, and Mark, you were mentioning the amount of bookkeeping that has to go into making sure the record keeping, to making sure that when captive animals are bred, you are not creating an inbreeding situation. Val, that's part of your job. You're actually the stud bookkeeper for the Bennett's wallaby. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, actually, I'm the species survival program coordinator for the Bennett's wallabies. And to be the coordinator, again, AZA has kind of gone different directions with the species survival program, but every stud bookkeeper has to go to class. So we learn what the best for the population is, and then we have multiple computer programs, and we also use the Population Management Center at Lincoln Park Zoo. A few of the things that we look at is to make sure that in the captive population that zoos want to display this animal, whether it's for education, for research, or for conservation, and if there's already a viable population in North America, if there's only 5 animals in North American Zoo, we probably have already gone too far and we're not able to have a good genetic diversity. We also want to make sure there's space and interest and that people want to learn about this animal so we don't place them in at zoos that don't know how to care for these animals. And we want to make sure that we maintain them in AZA-accredited institutions. Like you mentioned before, that the ACCI is going to be certified, hopefully. We don't want to just give it to anybody. We want to make sure that these animals are in the best care. A few other things that we look at, make sure there's a minimum of 20 animals and a minimum of 3 AZA institutions before we even start gathering information, because it really is a big undertaking. Each animal and AZA institutions that are part of the program are linked into a system, and we look at where they came from, all their relatives, and to see what their genetic diversity is. And the hope is that all these different animals at 100 years or 10 human generations that we can maintain a minimum of 90% genetic diversity.
So does every species that is under the purview of the ACA, does every species have someone like you who's assigned to keep track of these records?
Every species is kind of grouped into a larger group. The Bennett's wallabies is part of the marsupial and monotreme taxon advisory group. The chimpanzees and the bonobos are part of the ape taxonomy advisory group. And so there are a few species here and there who do not have a stud book. However, they are under the larger umbrella of the taxonomy advisory group. So we are looking at everything. But again, there are some of these species that we just, even though we can't do much about it, perhaps Europe or Australia or some other institutions or places that are accredited can work with them and we can trade. For example, the lion-tailed macaques, there has not been any breeding in AZA institutions in very many years. However, in Europe, they have a very good population. So we work together and to see if it's a good idea to send some of our younger animals over there to maintain that genetic diversity or what the best for the entire population is.
I think back to the extinction of the passenger pigeon, for example, and there was a small population of passenger pigeons that were living in a zoo, and the hope was that they would breed and that the species would stay alive, and they did not breed in captivity. So, Val, I mean, breeding animals in captivity is not as simple as just putting a couple of animals in the same area, right?
Correct. There's some species that they need to maintain in the same area. It was mentioned before, there might be bonobos that go to ACCI, or they might take some of the males that are currently residents there and take them someplace else, because you want to make sure that it's the best place to breed. Every location doesn't have the best place to breed. For example, the red panda, we hope to have a breeding pair, but the SSP coordinator for the red panda species knows that this species, if you give it about 3 to 5 years and they don't reproduce, it's time to change up things. Some reptiles are the same way. If you can move them to a different institution, sometimes they'll breed. And other species need to feel secure and they need to stay in a location much, much longer.
Now, of course, I can imagine that a big part of being involved in any breeding program in a captive environment is actually birth control, not just allowing the breeding to take place. Is that a huge challenge for you, Val, and for other zookeepers?
It's a huge challenge across all different species, and we're trying our best. There's a population management center in St. Louis that works with the reproduction, and we depend on their research a lot. We found out over the years that some of the different types of birth controls in some species are not reversible where we thought they would be. Different, like the ape species, you rely on human data. So perhaps like Hanzi had a vasectomy, and just like in humans, some are reversible, some are not. There's some implants that we use in multiple other species who in 3 years that implant is gone and we can reproduce. And that same implant in the same species could sterilize that animal and we have those genetics are have been lost. So even across species or even within the species, the birth control plan, we look at very, very heavily and we look ask other institutions. We ask the population management center and the reproductive center and make sure that we're using the correct products. So if we do need, you know, down the road to have this animal reproduce, that we have a reversible method.
And as technology has changed, the other part of the breeding situation is that we have a cryobank at San Diego that has 10,000 different samples in it from animals from all over the world, from actually tissue samples to eggs and sperm. And they have just recently accomplished the abilities to do some really wonderful things. And you'll be seeing soon that the northern white rhino was declared extinct. The last one died, I think, just a month or so ago in Kenya. But San Diego has both egg and sperm from northern white rhino dating back 20 years that they've cryogenically preserved. And this spring, they're going to put the egg and sperm together in a female southern white rhino and actually bring back a species that is extinct from the egg and sperm of the northern white rhino that is no longer existent. And as times change, these SSPs need to have that genetic diversity because they're having us take that genetic diversity and preserve it cryologically in San Diego to use down the road for species that have become extinct in the wild.
Now, species that have become extinct in the wild, the idea of preserving the species is very exciting, but is there a possibility, is there a hope that in the future these animals if they're bred successfully in captivity, could then be returned to the
wild? Yes. Actually, at the zoo, we just opened a new building, and it is, we call it the Sukup Large Mammal Breeding Center. And we have three species of antelope, the slender-horned antelope. They're a little 40-pound, really cute little guys. There's less than probably 300 of them in the wild. We have the Attix, which is a northern African species that can live in the mountains that is actually extinct in the wild. There are none left in the wild, and there are about 200 in captivity. And our goal was with four other zoos to breed enough of those animals over the next 3 or 4 years. And then with FedEx's help, and they've been a great corporate citizen, fly them to a protected preserve in Somalia and reintroduce those animals into the wild. The issue with that is, though, animals that are instinctive, an antelope is hardwired to eat, to run, and to breed. You can release those into the wild. The animals that are educated, primates and cats, that need to be have learned behaviors from their parents, that's a much harder situation, and we've not been very successful with that at all. A lion needs to teach his offspring how to hunt, and if he's in captivity, that doesn't happen. And the society of the primates is so sophisticated that the attempts to bring animals back into the wild, the wild animals come in and kill the captive animals. So, yeah, we are hoping to reintroduce many more species that are appropriate into the wild.
Jared, we had a question from Laya in Des Moines wanting to know, and I'm sure this is a question you get often about the exciting work that you're doing at the ACCI. She's asking if the public can visit ACCI, the bonobo facility.
Yeah, so we're not open to the public. To be honest with you, the facility just wasn't set up that way. It wasn't designed with that exhibiting in mind. Now, with that said, we have done and continue to do quite a bit to expand our education program. So school groups, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, any education group, continuing ed, and basically from preschool on up, we do try to honor requests for educational tours and visits, but we were not open to the public.
All right, and then if someone was trying to arrange something like that, they could contact the ACCI how?
Yeah, sure. There's an email address that you could just send, which is just the info, I-N-F-O, at apeinitiative.org.
In the future, this species, bonobos, are so fragile right now. As you mentioned, they're called endangered. They may be critically endangered. But Mark was just talking about the fact that this is a species where the education from the parents, from the greater ape family, the environment that infants are raised in, is incredibly important to their future survival. What do you see as the future of this species, Jared?
Right. Well, I mean, that's a great question. I think that when it comes to bonobos, I mean, Mark pointed out, I mean, it's sort of a very, very good point that needs to be made, which is that there's a bonobo infants spend 5+ years being very dependent upon their moms, as do chimpanzees, as do other great apes. And during the course of that time, they're building social bonds and they're learning about their environment. We know that bonobos, like other great apes, are that as smart as they are because there's a lot to learn out in the forest. And survival is hard. So one of the things that we see as our mission is getting people to really appreciate how incredible these species are, which hopefully is going to motivate people to take steps to preserve the species and the habitat they live in, which, of course, then brings all the species that live in that habitat under an umbrella. So that's really kind of how we see things going. And I am optimistic that we'll be able to turn things around for these species in their natural habitat. That's kind of really why we're working so hard.
Well, Jared Tagliatella, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
And keep us posted as things develop at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative as well.
I certainly will. Thanks so much, Jared. I appreciate it.
Jared Tagliatella is the Director of Research at ACCI and an Associate Professor at Kennesaw State University in Georgia. And Mark, before we're out of time, the conservation message that Jared was just talking about has become a very important part of the mission at Blank Park Zoo and many zoos around the world. I mean, tell me what you hope that people who visit the zoo take away from the experience.
Well, we talked about those SSP programs, and the zoo has an organization called SAFE, Saving Animals from Extinction, that has 100 animals that are critically endangered. And critically endangered now has been established as gone in a human generation. So 100 animals that you see in zoos in this country, at the current rate of what's going on in the wild, will only be seen in zoos in a generation from now. So we hope that when you come to Blank Park Zoo, we can impact you to make some decisions about helping us save those animals so they will be still available in the wild through conservation, through volunteerism, through dollars to organizations. The goal is that we're the focus
Mark,
point that you can see
out of
those
time,
animals.
But thank you so much, Mark Vukovich and Val Hodakite of Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.